June 10th, 2016, and it's finally here. The Bobcast is underway. Our weekly cruise through sports and pop culture, our weekly peruse through sports and pop culture, I think we'll stick with a weekly tour of sports and pop culture. I'm your tour guide, Bobby Manning. And before we get into anything today, I want to extend a big thank you to Nick Gelso for sponsoring me through this process, mentoring me through starting up this podcast. I want to thank Mike Diachizen, a good friend of mine, for helping me design the logo, a beautiful logo with a very nice Syracuse orange theme to it. And I want to thank another friend of mine, Edgar Castro, for helping digitize the logo. It looks fantastic. You can see it on our Facebook page, on our Twitter page, at The Bobcast Show. Especially want to thank Adam Kaufman of 98.5 and many other platforms, who's going to be with us as our first guest, Episode 1, The Bobcast, a weekly tour of sports and pop culture getting underway. You can follow me at Real Bob Manning on Twitter. You can follow the show, as I said before, at The Bobcast Show. And let's get into the structure of the show a little bit, introduce The Bobcast. So we're going to have the controversial, the invigorating, and we're going to try to be innovative here on this show, touching on all corners of sports and pop culture. Every show is going to have a little unique spin to it, depending on who our guest is, a Boston sports personality like Adam. We're going to have a Boston sports spin to it. We're going to do about 5 to 10 minutes of quick-hitting intro on some hot topics in sports and pop culture Fridays here on the Bobcast. Then we'll jump into a 15-20-minute interview with a unique guest each week from the worlds of sports, pop culture, and entertainment. And we have some great guests lined up for this first month. We'll get to some of the other ones in the coming weeks. And then we'll do about a 5 to 10 minute outro, stories with big impacts around the world of sports. We'll try to get you out of here in 30 to 35 minutes. We're not going to be one of those hour, 2 hour long podcasts that you basically need to hop on a plane and fall asleep listening to. We're going to be nice, quick, and thorough here on the Bobcast. So a little bit about myself. Some of you may know me, some of you may not. Some of you may follow me on Twitter, which has been my main platform for my own takes and discussion on sports throughout my journey. And it really has been a journey now. A week ago to this day, I graduated from Peabody High School. I'm a Boston boy, born in Boston, spent a few years in the city before I ventured to the North Shore. Peabody, Massachusetts is where I've resided for most of my life. And in a few months, I'll be off to Syracuse University, where I'm going to take the next step in that journey. And it all got started in 2012. I was very into sports at a young age, and I wasn't the best athlete. I've improved immensely through the years, I will say. But that aside, the journey here started when my cousin, on Thanksgiving Day 2012, it's a day I'll never forget, said, you know, Bobby, you talk about sports all the time. You're always throwing your takes out to me. Why don't you start a sports blog? And I did, and it's been an incredible journey with that early blog that I had to beg my friends to read. I believe it was called Manning Sports. A guy named Chris Sanborn is my next collaboration. We wrote for about a year on the New England sports blog on Patriots, Red Sox, and whatever thoughts went through our mind back then. And then I moved on to some more serious ventures. I covered my Peabody High School football, Tanners, for 2 years, and that was just an incredible journey that I'll get to in a different episode. That's a whole story that I'll need to get into with you guys, and it's a great one at that. And then Mark Vanderson brought me in at Celtics Life. He's a man I'm forever grateful for. He helped me improve my writing immensely in my time there. He let me cover my favorite team, as many of you know, is the Celtics. I talk about the Celtics endlessly. I'm sure I'll talk about the Celtics to a great degree on this program, but that won't be our main focus, and I'll try not to overload you with green team discussion. We'll get into that a little bit with Adam, though, in a few minutes. I spent about 6 months at Celtics Life while writing at Examiner.com, where I still write today, covering some big stories in Boston sports. I mostly write columns there, about one, two, maybe three a month. And then I ran into Kevin O'Connor at a Celtics game, Celtics Warriors, one of the best games of the NBA season. And I introduced myself to him, gave him my journey up to that point. I can't thank him enough for bringing me in at Celtics Blog, where I've written since January, and that's my main platform right now. You can find my work up there. I recently wrote about about Kevin Durant. What else will we be talking about in Celtics world? Me and Adam will discuss the man all Celtics fans have their eyes on coming up in a little bit. From Celtics Blog, I got some other opportunities. Celtics Stuff Live brought me in for a trade deadline show in February. That was a whole lot of fun, and from there, I got an opportunity to do Celtics post-game shows on CLNS Radio. I did about 6-7 of those. That helped me grow as a broadcaster, which I hadn't had a lot of experience with. I try to cover all bases of sports media, pursue a career in it, which is my eventual goal in Syracuse. And that's just what this is a part of. Hopefully with the Bobcast, I can improve my craft as an interviewer, as a speaker, and continue to hit every base until I make it to home plate to throw a sports cliche at you. I'm sure there'll be plenty of those on this show. We'll try to limit them, though. That brings us here, the Bobcast. This has been a dream of mine to have my own show, my own platform for years. It finally became a reality a few months ago, and I've been working on it through May into June, and now here's our first episode. So I want to thank all of you who have followed me on Twitter through this process. I want to thank anybody who listens to this show. It means the world to me. This platform is going to become very personal, and I'm going to pour my heart and soul into it to make it a better program for you and hopefully give you some entertainment and insight with the help of some great guests. And that's going to bring us to our first guest, who I'm going to introduce a little bit before bringing him on, Adam Kaufman. This guy can truly be described as a Boston sports extraordinaire. He's an inspiration of mine. Back in 2012, as I said before, he was one of the first people I spoke with when I got my voice out there and wanted some advice on what to do in this. And one thing he told me back then that I carry with me to this day is try to do a little bit of everything. There's so many things you can do in sports media in the 21st century in 2016. So I've written, I've done beats, and now here I am broadcasting. And I'm following in his footsteps out to Syracuse. Kaufman's a Syracuse graduate himself, and I can't say that without mentioning that that's probably my main inspiration for looking into the college in the first place. And I'm sure he feels the same way as I do about it. It's just an incredible place. It's going to be an incredible venue for me to continue my career. A little bit about Kaufman. I don't know how he gets any sleep because I run a few ventures myself, and this guy does 10 times as much as I do. He's the host Saturdays on Celtics at 7, on Saturday mornings on 98.5 The Sports Hub, a fantastic show at that. He writes columns at Boston Sports, Boston.com, not BostonSports.com. He's an on-air talent on NESN, and he's done it all across the media landscape from his days at Syracuse as a young broadcaster to covering the Patriots Super Bowl parade in 2014. I was there too. That was an incredible event. He was live on the streets during the Boston Marathon this past year, so we'll talk to him about that and more. Welcome to the tour, Adam Kaufman. It's nice to have you here. How are you doing on this fine Friday afternoon?
Bobby, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me. It's I appreciate all the kind words, almost overwhelming. I wish you all the luck with obviously this venture, and it's an honor to be the first guest.
We're going to throw it back to your days at my age. The Red Sox drafted a 17-year-old pitcher from high school yesterday, and I want to know a little bit of what you were doing at 17 years old. When did your connection with sports begin, and what pushed you towards a career in sports media?
I guess like most of my stories, it's a long and winding one, but I'll try not to bore you with all the details. I guess kind of the bullet point version is growing up, my parents were real big sports fans. I actually really wasn't all that big a sports fan at all in my really early year. I'm not the most athletic guy you'll ever come across. I definitely like to think I'm a bit better than the reality of it. But one thing I did do a lot of was collect cards. And I think, kind of lame as this may sound, I really started to enjoy collecting the cards of all sports, baseball more often than not, but really all the sports. And I just kind of got obsessed with reading the backs of the cards and learning more about the guys and sort of obsessing over the statistics. And then like any kid, you know, you make trades with your buddies and you got the Becketts and you're looking up the values of all of them. And anyway, that, you know, sort of collecting cards in a backwards way led me to starting to actually watch more sports and follow these guys more closely and reading the paper and studying box scores and just trying to commit everything to memory and so on. And so really, by the time I was, I don't know, 15, 16, maybe a little bit earlier than that, I sort of similar to your story, I think similar to a lot of people's stories where it's, you know, you just kind of grow obsessed with sports and then those one or two people along the way say, hey, you know, sort of seems like you know what you're talking about. You should think about doing this for a living. And a couple people pointed me in the direction of Syracuse, which is where Sean McDonough went. And he was really at your age for me. When I was 16, 17, he was a real mentor for me and started to intern on Red Sox broadcasts. I think it was the summer going into my senior year of high school. I was a bit young for an intern, but it was an unbelievable experience. And that sort of everything really kind of took off from there.
He mentioned Syracuse. We're all part of the Syracuse legacy now, or I eventually will be. How would you describe the sports scene at Syracuse compared to the one you grew up around in Boston? Was there a single moment you ran into there that helped bring you to the next level as a sports media guy?
Well, I mean, it's a passionate sports city in terms of the fans, but obviously one big difference is it's all about the college game or to a certain degree the minor league sports level, mostly college. I mean, the locals there, the townies, if you will, and you'll come to find this when you're there, people are obsessed with Syracuse basketball, with Syracuse football, to a lesser degree lacrosse, as good as that team is historically. The women's basketball team, which was a joke when I was there, has much improved in recent years under Coach Q. And you've got the Syracuse Crunch there, the AAA hockey team. You got the Syracuse Chiefs, the AAA baseball team, who a friend of mine is the GM of. And it's all of these sports programs there, be it affiliated with the university or outside of that. It's not the biggest city in the world, you know, and everything really revolves around that campus. So it's passionate, not unlike Boston, but in a very different way. I mean, here, I don't need to tell you, we're passionate about our pro teams, the Red Sox, the Patriots, the Celtics, the Bruins. We don't really spend a whole lot of time focusing on college sports here. So it's in that way, it's going to be kind of a culture shock for you because it's all about college and minor pro there and not the pro team, because they're the closest pro teams you've got are New York City or, you know, Philadelphia. It's a totally different sort of way of life, but in a really exciting way. So it's a blast.
So from Syracuse, you moved on to a lot of different locations. I see you spent time in Texas, New Jersey, among other places working. What new perspectives did you get from those places about what makes a great sports city and environment now, having Boston, Syracuse, and some of those other places under your belt by that point?
Well, look, when you're from Boston, and I think this is true of a lot of people from a lot of different places, but especially when you're from Boston, when you're from New York City, when you're from, you know, LA, other major, not only major markets in terms of the media, but major sports markets, you get out of college and you've got that more often than not unrealistic pipe dream of, all right, I'm out of college, time to hit the work world, I want to go home, I want to go cover Boston sports immediately. And some people are fortunate enough to do it. Most are not. Some go off wherever and never make it back here. So I consider myself very lucky to be here covering the teams that I love and that I grew up rooting for and cheering for and all of that. But it, you know, sort of to answer your question, the experience that I had first being in New York and then being in Virginia and Texas and New York and again and Rhode Island and Maine and Michigan. I lived in a whole bunch of different places before sort of settling in back home, and that was awesome. I mean, I'm not going to lie and say every single step along the way was the most rewarding or the most fun or was surrounded by the best people, but more often than not, that was the case. And I loved being able to do that and live in different parts of the country, to live in the South, to live in the, not entirely out West, but West Texas anyway, so kind of around Colorado and Oklahoma. That's about as far west as I lived. In the Midwest in Michigan, obviously the Northeast, and, you know, a little bit further south on the East Coast, being in Virginia, all sort of different parts and different places where different things are important and the people are important and the types of teams that you cover. Everybody brings something different to the table culturally, which I think that growth that you experience, if you're willing to take it all in, only makes you better. Makes you better as a person, makes you better at your job, makes you more passionate. And, you know, I think there's not enough people, I think, necessarily recognize the value in getting out of college and getting out of your comfort zone and going somewhere else, you know, somewhere away from your friends, away from your family, you know, meeting new friends who become like family, and getting that experience to just really, I said it before, but to say it again, to get out of your comfort zone and test yourself, because there's a lot of personal growth that comes from that I just think betters you.
Yeah, it's a great journey, and I've even been amazed in some of my experiences where the journey has brought myself in just a few short years. I got to ask you, what brought you back to Boston? At what moment did you realize you were going to be coming home and covering the sports you love here?
Well, my goal was always to make it back here, and fortunately I did it within a few years or a couple of years of getting out of college, despite all those other places that I lived for varying amounts of time. I mean, I didn't spend a full calendar year in any of one of those places because I sort of went from job to job to job, but that moment, if you will, was living in Texas. I was broadcasting and doing media and PR relations, all of that for a team, the Amarillo Gorillas, which no longer exist in the Central Hockey League, which also I'm not even sure still exists. It might emerge with the ECHL at this point. But I was working for that team, and an opportunity came across our fax machine, not that people really use those anymore, with Providence Bruins, the AAA feeder team to the Boston Bruins of the American Hockey League, were looking for a broadcaster to do half the games. They had already had a guy that was going to do the road games. They wanted a guy that was going to do the home games and also help out with media and PR and that sort of thing. And I happened to know the guy that was broadcasting the games there, and he was able to help me out a little bit just in terms of having an interview and making sure I was in the conversation. That everything worked out. I was able to get that job. I moved back home, and I was there at, I want to say, 26 years old, and spent the better part of 5 years there before sort of further branching out into the Boston market from the Providence and Rhode Island market.
That brings us back to Boston as a sports community, and we'll connect it to Kevin Durant. I know some people love talking about Kevin Durant. Some people think it's a pipe dream, but across Boston sports, we've seen it. The Red Sox have attracted top free agents. There's a big money factor there. The Bruins have drawn big fish like Jerome Iginla most recently. The Patriots go out and get their guys when they want them, but when it comes to the Boston Celtics, they've had issues throughout their history bringing in big free agents. I think the consensus is that the biggest guy they ever landed was
Wilkins, who obviously, if that's what you're thinking of from the Hawks. But even still, he's a guy that was well past his prime. He was 35 years old when he came to Boston. So if you want to make the claim that the Boston Celtics have never signed a marquee free agent in his prime, you'd be correct.
There's a racial history of the city that I haven't been a big part of, but it's been mentioned before. The weather stinks here. You can't get around that. And there's other factors, but why shouldn't a great team with 17 championships and an intense fan base and, as we've covered already, a great sports community not attract big names like, say, a Kevin Durant?
Well, a convoluted issue. You know, there are a lot of different elements to it. I think a lot of us like to, and you'll hear this from ownership. I talked to Whit Grosbeck, co-owner of the Celtics, the other day. A lot of people will like to point at the 17 banners and the chase for 18 and winning his franchise and NBA history and all of that stuff, and it's wonderful. It looks good on a business card. Sounds good in a sales pitch. But today's athletes, for the most part, don't care about what your franchise did 30, 50 years ago. They care about, can they come in and win now? And the Celtics are led by one of the up-and-coming coaches in the NBA, in Brad Stevens. I would already consider him a top five, definitely top 10 coach in the league. And they've got a good young nucleus of players. Nobody's untouchable. And an all-star in Isaiah Thomas on a team-friendly contract and a treasure trove of a draft pick. So they're and obviously stable ownership and front office, Danny Ainge, all of that's, you know, there are a lot of great things about Boston, but what it doesn't have that some other teams and cities do is, you know, the weather in Boston sucks. It's not Miami, it's not LA, it's not Houston, San Antonio, Phoenix, wherever. And you know, we get a lot of snow here. People don't like that. It's not New York City where the clubs are open till 4 or 5 in the morning. Everything shuts down here by 1 or 2 o'clock. You know, you got to go to Chinatown and ask for cold tea if you want to be able to drink after 2. The state income tax or sales taxes, you know, there's no state tax in Florida,
Texas.
In Texas. So it's not as high in Massachusetts as it is in some other places, but it exists. So it's, you know, a deal that if you're offering a guy a I don't know, $115 million to sign with the Celtics, and Houston's offering him that same $115 million, well, it's not the same $115 million because he's not going to lose state taxes at 6.25%. So that's a lot more money in his pocket, even though on the surface it looks like the same. So it's there are a lot of different things that in my mind, and obviously I can't even begin to relate to it on a personal level. I'm not African-American, and I would argue that things have changed. Society, it's more progressive than it was a long, long time ago. But for me, it's the weather, it's sales tax, it's who do you have on your roster? You don't have any superstars, ability to win right now, all that stuff that I already said well before it's even the race issue. Quite frankly, I mean, the Celtics were the first team to integrate African-Americans and break the color barrier. So it's not like the Celtics, it's not the Red Sox and Tom Yawkey, all of that stuff. The Celtics have a totally different history in that respect. You know, I just think, unfortunately, they need to be able to get that first superstar here. And one thing worth mentioning, too, and I know I'm rambling a bit here, in terms of the past versus now, the Celtics have never had this kind of salary cap space available to them that they have now, to the ability to sign two max level free agents. You know, they didn't, in the new Big Three era with Pierce and Garnett and Allen, they didn't have that ability. They had to bring in guys on mid-level exceptions and short, small deals. James Posey, Eddie House, Rasheed Wallace, P.J. Brown, you know, at the end of the season there. All these guys, they could have, it's not that they couldn't attract guys. I mean, they got, you know, rejected by David West, and it would have been great if he came here. But generally speaking, it's not that they've had that much trouble since that time, you know, when they're competitive anyway, in that window of a handful of years when they were in attracting guys. Just they didn't have the space to be able to do it financially. Now they do, which is part anyway of what's going to make this summer that we're in right now so fascinating when we get to July 1st and the start of free agency.
Yeah, and well, until Kevin Durant signs back in Oklahoma City, which is what I believe he's going to do, or if he ends up anywhere else, the news is going to keep coming. We heard yesterday Legal Seafoods is giving them the free crab legs for life. I give them credit on that for going
Fasten's
back to...
Fasten's offered them free ride.
I give Legal Seafoods credit. That was a very small point in a 2010 interview with him, and they went back and found that, so good for them. We'll see if it plays any impact. I doubt it, but Terrence Knighton's out there recruiting him. The whole city believes, or some of the city at least believes, that there's a chance, whether it's a 1% chance or a 10% chance, there is some chance out there. What do you think the chance is that the appeal of Boston, the Celtics, somehow, by some miracle, draws Kevin Durant in?
I don't think it's going to happen. I've been talking about this for months on end, you know, to the point where I'm probably obnoxious about it. I mean, do I think they'll get a meeting with him? Yeah, I do. I think he'll come in, he'll listen to the sales pitch, or they'll have to go to him, whatever the case may be. But I just don't think it's realistic. I think, you know, for my money, he's going to re-sign with Oklahoma City. But if that doesn't happen, you've got San Antonio, much closer to being able to win, albeit in a tougher conference, potentially Golden State, his hometown or home city of Washington. I think it's there are a lot of teams that you're going to hear about that are chasing him. And of course, I mean, virtually every team in the NBA would love to have a guy like Kevin Durant and would try and make a push for Kevin Durant now that everyone with that new TV deal in the NBA has an extra $20+ million at their disposal. But as far as him coming to Boston, that would have to be Danny Ainge has done a lot of great things, a lot of great things for this team, for this franchise and its history. A million, it just feels like so many great moves, whether it's the Nets blockbuster, the trade for Isaiah Thomas, giving up nothing, the being
Kevin
able
Garnett
to being able to assemble the everything he did during that 2007 summer. There are a lot of good things that he's done. This, to me, would be his biggest miracle. I just don't think he's going to be able to pull it off, which is no knock on him. I just don't think Kevin Durant's coming here. I couldn't even guess the odds, but it would be very, very, very low.
He may have already gotten his only miracle of his career with Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen and Paul Pierce, who we'll talk about next. Paul Pierce is mulling retirement. On the jump yesterday, he said he's 50-50 on retiring. And when it comes to the Mount Rushmore of Celtics legends, you got Larry Bird, you got Bill Russell, and somewhere among the legends in the Hall of Fame and hanging up in the rafters, Paul Pierce is going to sit one day. So I got to ask you, what was your first memory of Paul Pierce in green, and what is his Celtics legacy if this is the end for him?
Boy, I mean, I guess my first memory is even before he was in green. It goes back to draft night. I mean, I distinctly remember being at a buddy's house with a whole bunch of other friends. We were kids. It was, what, 1998 he was drafted? So I was 16. We were all at a friend's house, I think, having a party, and we were there late. We were watching the draft while we were hanging out, and I just couldn't believe he was falling. Of the things that Rick Pitino did right when he was in Boston, there are very few, but that was one of them, being able to take Paul Pierce there. So I was just thrilled right from the get-go. Not that I ever envisioned him being one of the Celtics legends. I wouldn't put him on that Mount Rushmore, but certainly a legend of his era in a Celtics uniform and a champion, and nobody can take that away from him. I think he just did so many great things. You can go on and on about his accomplishments on and off the court as it concerns this city, and the fact that he really got himself right after that what could have been a really tragic event at the nightclub when he was stabbed so many times. That was one of the things that really got his career on track, ironically enough. And the fact that he never even missed time as a result of it is even more shocking. But, if this is the end, I mean, it probably should be in terms of what he seems to have left in the tank as a player. But I love him. It was a lot of fun watching him and being able to cover him to the extent that I did anyhow. And, I think that he's going to retire a Celtic. I don't think he'll play for the Celtics again, but I think he'll, do the whole one-day contract and retire as a Celtic. He's spoken for a long time about a desire to be in an NBA front office, to be in, maybe be a GM one day. I know he's kind of dinking around trying his hand at broadcasting right now with the finals going on, but I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up getting hired by Danny Ainge and the Celtic and getting indoctrinated into that after basketball lifestyle like Ainge and so many others have done, sort of become an ambassador or be an addition to the front office, something like that. But I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up being around Boston in the very short-term future here, which would be great. And then, of course, that 34 will absolutely and deservedly be up in the rafters at the Garden.
Yeah, I was at that first game back when he came back with the Nets that first year after they traded him, and I can truly say, I don't know where you were that night, but being in the crowd then, I don't think there was ever a more emotional sports moment in my life. There's two times I've cried in my sports life. The 2010 finals, watching there, thinking about going to the Celtics championship parade, and then watching them completely lose control of the game in the fourth quarter. That brought me to tears when I was 12 years old back then. And that night in the Garden, I couldn't help it. I've never heard the TD Garden louder. I've never heard as much passion around an entire stadium. And just seeing their reactions and what they meant to the Celtics, it was just incredible. And he went off to Washington after that, 15.2 player efficiency rating that year in Washington, the big playoff moments. And then last year in Los Angeles, I agree with you. It looked like he was on his last legs. He went from a 15.2 to a 6.1 player efficiency rating. He got a bad injury at the end of the year. So he's 50-50 on it. I think we're going to see the end of Paul Pierce right now. I got to ask you, too, do you think it matters for his legacy as a Boston athlete that he didn't spend his whole career here?
No. It doesn't. I mean, Bobby Orton spent his whole career here. Does anybody talk about that?
No.
David Ortiz, whenever he does retire, he won't have spent his entire career here. Obviously, he didn't leave. That's totally different. But he arrived late, through no fault of his own. Pedro Martinez didn't spend his whole career here by any stretch. He pitched for a bunch of different teams. You think about some of the legends of this market, and hopefully Tom Brady does spend his whole career here. But he may not. He may spend a year or two elsewhere at the end if he's trailing off and the Patriots decide it's time to move on to Jimmy Garoppolo or Jacoby Brissett or who else that we're not even aware of right now. I don't think it affects anything. I think it would have been nice because it so rarely happens today. Kobe Bryant just did it. Derek Jeter did it. But it's so rare that an athlete spends, a Hall of Fame caliber athlete spends his entire career in one place. But I don't think it hurts Paul Pierce any that he was traded away. It's not like he left as a free agent. He was moved.
And what a beautiful move it was. And it's might just set up the next Celtics championship when it's all said and done. The 4-3 draft picks they got from Brooklyn and the pick swap. Probably going to go down as Danny Ainge's second best move ever as GM here.
All depends how those chips fall.
And we'll see that on June 23rd with the NBA draft coming up. That's a big moment for the Celtics. Probably their biggest moment as a team since that day when they traded Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce and Jason Terry, of course, to the Brooklyn Nets. So we're here with Adam Kaufman talking Boston sports, Texas sports, Syracuse sports, and we're going to send you packing in 1 second from the Bobcast, Adam Kaufman. But before you go, and now that you've returned home, what are you hoping to accomplish before your career in sports media comes to an end, especially with how much the industry seems to change every year?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm 34, so I'm hoping I'm nowhere near the end. I like to think in a lot of ways I'm hopefully just kind of getting started. But, I don't know. People ask me all the time, what do you want to do? What's your goal? It's a popular question. I never have a very good answer for it because, pretty simply, my main objective is I just want to love what I'm doing. And that's the case right now. I do. I want to work with good people as I do. I want to have the opportunity to cover the teams that I love, which I'm having fun doing. But also, I really enjoy the national work that I do too, and covering teams outside of the Boston market. So I believe me when I say, of all the things that I could ramble about, this is an area I could ramble. But the simplest way to kind of put it is, I just want to have a good time, because one of the more important things in whatever you do, whatever walk of life, you don't want your work to feel like work. You want it to be fun. You want to wake up in the morning and be energized and excited and looking forward to going to do whatever it is that you have to do that's going to fill those 8 hours or those 18 hours, whatever it ends up being that you wind up working. And the fact I work 6 days a week right now at a minimum, oftentimes seven, and I'm not complaining because I love what I do. Other people who are whatever job that it's simply there to pay the bills can hardly handle the thought of working 5 days a week. So it's, I consider myself very fortunate, very lucky. And obviously, to anyone, whether they work in sports or business or medicine or teaching or whatever it is, anything, I hope that they feel the same way, because that's the kind of energy that you need. It helps you strive to try and make yourself better and be as good as you can be at whatever it is that you do.
We've had a lot of fun with you here today, Adam, and I think it's really cool that you've been able to use your career to have an impact on a young hopeful like me, and I can say right here on the air that I appreciate everything you've done for me, from talking to me, giving me advice and all that.
So, believe me, it means even more to me, I assure you. Wish you all the best.
So that's Adam Kaufman, Celtics at 7, Saturdays on 98.5 The Sports Hub. You can read him at boston.com. And many other platforms. Follow him at Adam M. Kaufman on Twitter, and be sure to see whatever he's working on. We appreciate you joining us on the first Bobcast, Adam, and hope you have a great Friday.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bobby, and here's to, hundreds more of these things. Good luck.
Thank you. That'll bring us to our closing segment. We're going to hit on some big stories happening in sports right now between the finals, PEDs in sports, and the Yordano Ventura suspension. So let's head to that first story. Bill Reuters yesterday, CBS Sports wrote a great story about narratives in these NBA finals. And before you hear this, game four of the finals will probably already have happened. It's scheduled to tip off tonight, with Cleveland pulling within 1-2 on the defending champion Golden State Warriors. And one of the big things that sort of annoyed people with these NBA finals and these playoffs in general is the narrative play. When the Warriors took a 2-0 lead, a lot of people were saying they were going to sweep the Cavaliers. A lot of people saying, will LeBron leave Cleveland again? Just taking these extreme positions. And Bill Reuter of CBS wrote a great piece on how Cleveland's 30-point win the other night in Game 3 sort of shifted that. He says, this wasn't just a huge win that cut the Warriors' series lead to 2-1. It was among a throng of Cavs fans at Quicken Loans Arena who again pinned their long-suffering hopes on LeBron James and his promise to be the chosen one. A game that addressed the NBA's reigning narratives, answered the critics, and reminded us all that winning a championship and how we view those teams that get so close to doing so is much more complicated than hot takes and quick headlines. And you saw another hot take from one J.R. Smith today, chiming in saying that Steph Curry shouldn't have been MVP. It should have been LeBron. It should have been Russell Westbrook. How about that for a hot take? The guy who was the centerpiece of a 73-win team, the only 73-win team in the history of the NBA, the guy who led the NBA in scoring this year, the guy who made the Western Conference, a brutal Western Conference at that, his once again. shouldn't have been MVP because of a 30-point loss. And don't get me wrong, Steph Curry has struggled in this series. He hasn't come up as big as many have hoped, but the fact that he shouldn't have won MVP because of his finals performance, first, that's wrong, because the MVP is for regular season accomplishment. And it's another example of the narrative play that the Cavaliers have been victim of, and now the Warriors have fallen victim of, too. And how about the notion that Kevin Love stinks? You've heard that all over this week. Kevin Love suffered a concussion in Game 2. The Cavaliers come back in Game 3 without him and win handily. And the takeaway among many is that Kevin Love stinks. The Cavaliers are going to have to dump Kevin Love this offseason. And don't get me wrong, Kevin Love has his issues that I've pointed out extensively. He's an awful defender. He has trouble getting involved in that Cleveland offense. And it seems like at times he has trouble getting in with the chemistry of that Cavaliers team. So, you know, there may be more there in Cleveland that we don't know about, but the fact that he stinks and that the Cavaliers are better without him, I can't buy into at all. This is a former All-Star, a former rebounding champion, one of the best big man shooters in the NBA, and now we've spun a narrative based on 3 games that he's not as good as we think he is. Now, spin that whatever way you want, but I don't think 3 games are going to suddenly spin what NBA GMs and other people in the game see Kevin Love as. And if the Cavaliers want to take that extreme position and move him this summer, I'll be more than happy as the Celtics to take Kevin Love aboard. Just remember, 2 years ago, Kevin Love was sitting by Fenway Park, and Celtics fans were clamoring about the possibility of Kevin Love coming to Boston. And now I bet a lot of Celtics fans would just turn their nose at the notion because of the narrative we've written. And speaking of that narrative, I can point to a main culprit of it, and it's just the fact that we've seen so many blowouts this NBA playoff season. According to Point After, the average margin of victory among victors this NBA playoff season is 14.2 points per game. And that's the most since 1995-1996, when during those playoffs, the average victor won by 12.8 points per game. And that's before the finals even began, and we got 2 30-point victories each way. So we're going to see this postseason shatter the record from the average margin of victory. And I think that's a big reason where you're getting these narrative plays. If the Warriors come out tonight and win by 20-30, I think you'll see that swing their way again. And if the Cavaliers win, ooh, there's going to be some big stories around the Warriors heading back to Golden State. But it's a 7-game series. Like Ryder said, winning a championship is hard. And sometimes we need to hold back on the narratives a little bit. We in the media. Don't get me wrong, I love a good narrative, but a narrative based on 1 game? Sorry, J.R. Smith, it doesn't hold up. Next, we move to PEDs in sports. Maria Sharapova got a 2-year suspension from the International Tennis Federation for what she claims was a circulation drug that a lot of people in East Europe use to help with circulation, I guess. Sounds a lot like some of the excuses we hear from athletes over here, but does that take away from her 5 Grand Slam singles, being named number 1 in the world in 2005, a silver medal in London, and countless other achievements as one of the best women tennis players we've ever seen? I say no. You can have your own take on that as you will, but I don't think PED revelations should have an impact on how we view athletes' accomplishments. Should we look at the clean guys and what they did and have more respect for them? Sure, but who do we really know is and isn't clean, especially when in the MLB, which is where the PED conversation has mainly been held? Through the 90s, we didn't really know who was and who wasn't clean. I mean, we have an idea that Barry Bonds was on steroids. We saw him balloon to a massive hitter. But is Ken Griffey Jr. clean? Was Pedro Martinez? Some of these other guys who had their best years in the 90s? We'll just never know because the MLB, frankly, didn't make a huge effort to pursue that. If you're an athlete in these sports, there's going to be risk versus reward. What you eat, what you do with your body is going to be your decision. And I'm not going to ruthlessly hate an athlete just because they try to get that edge with PEDs. And if they get slammed, like Maria Sharapova did, I'm not going to feel bad for them either. The International Tennis Federation wants to send a message with 2 years. They originally wanted 4 years, which would have been crazy. But if they want to send a message to Sharapova and other tennis athletes out there, then we're not going to condone this. Go ahead. I'm just not going to look at her past achievements and turn my nose to those. And that brings us to the final topic of the Bobcast, throwing at batters in baseball. Yordano Ventura has been in the news lately, getting a 9-game suspension for throwing at Manny Machado. Machado himself, the third baseman and shortstop for the Baltimore Orioles, got a 4-game suspension. And it just brings me back to the unwritten rules of baseball. And Jeff Passan wrote about the situation earlier this week for Yahoo Sports. He said, recently inside the Kansas City Royals clubhouse, Yordano Ventura was talking about how he planned on hitting Jose Bautista with a pitch the next time he faced him. The people around Ventura rolled their eyes, tired of the bluster, done with the immaturity, hopeful that he was playing Fugazi instead of the on-field arsonist they've seen too many times for their liking. Among his teammates and in the Royals front office alike, they've long waited for Ventura to grow up, only to end up amazed at how he manages to plumb beneath even his own low standards. Now, don't get me wrong. Ventura has had his issues throwing at batters and immaturity that have been extensively covered this week, so we don't even need to get into that. But this brings me back to one of my long-held takes on the unwritten rules of baseball and how they frustrated me throughout the years because of their hypocrisy. Manny Machado gets hit with the pitch, and he has to charge the mound to defend himself, and he gets a 4-game suspension. We're going to miss Ventura for 9 games, which doesn't affect him as severely because he only pitches every 5 games. But these are two of the best players in baseball now thrown under the cloud of suspension because of the stupid unwritten rules of baseball. Now, Machado himself was the victim in this circumstance, as I see we can all agree. But Machado himself threw a bat down the line several years ago at then Athletics third baseman Josh Donaldson because Donaldson tagged him too hard. Because Josh Donaldson, the ultimate competitor and AL MVP last season at that, tagged Manny Machado too hard. He felt the need to throw a bat down the third baseman line at him. And don't get me wrong, I'm not ripping Machado for falling in line with these rules because it's almost expected at this point, and Machado himself on the field has been a fantastic athlete. He may very well be the AL MVP this year, but throwing at batters, throwing bats down the line at players because of intensity in the game of baseball just makes no sense to me. And we talked about Jose Bautista already and how Ventura wanted to take his revenge on him for a bat flip. A bat flip from Jose Bautista, a show of intensity for one of the greatest moments in Toronto baseball history when he hit a massive home run to help Toronto beat Texas last postseason. For one of the biggest moments in Toronto baseball history, Jose Bautista flipping his bat sent the MLB into such a frenzy that Yordano Ventura felt the need to throw at him this year. Odor of the Texas Rangers felt the need to punch him in the face, which was all, of course, a different situation, but I'm sure the bat flip played into it. And people across baseball just felt the need to rip and scold Jose Bautista, one of the most exciting players in baseball, for his flash of power, his great fielding abilities, his booming arm that have helped the Blue Jays become one of the best teams in baseball over the past few years. They're angry at this guy because he shows excitement. When baseball has an attendance issue, a pace of play issue, a TV ratings issue, and that comes down to how exciting the game is for people to watch. So when Jose Bautista caps off one of the best moments anyone has seen on a baseball field with an exclamatory bat flip, we're going to vilify him and engage the baseball code on him and throw balls at him and punch him in the face. And Ventura, because he shared some words with Manny Machado or had a little underlying dispute with him, felt the need to peg him. And now they both have to sit aside and paying customers don't get to see two of the most exciting players in baseball. I just think the unwritten rules of baseball are complete hypocrisy, and I've been adamantly against them since I started covering the game. I even wrote an article about it for Baseball Essential back in my time there in 2014, and I can cue that up for you later at Real Bob Manning on Twitter. But for now, that will be it for our first episode. And I want to thank each and one of you who listened to this first show from the bottom of my heart. I want to thank Adam Kaufman for being the first guest in Bobcast history. That concludes this tour of sports and pop culture. June 10th, 2016. We'll see you next week. June 17th, 2016, with another very special guest, Snotty Drippin, the king of basketball Twitter. That is a guest you do not want to miss. Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you next Friday for the Bobcast. This is Bobby Manning signing out. Follow me at Real Bob Manning and follow the show at The Bobcast Show. Peace!